In this week's episode, Katie Singer's joined by chartered management accountant Gary Smith. They discuss all things about Bitcoin, such as the history, what it really is, and some of the tax implications surrounding it. We must preface this episode by stating that all opinions given are their own and none of what is discussed should be constituted as financial advice. Accountancy on Prescription by RBP, one of the leading firms of medical specialist accountants. We know what you find tough, but don't you worry, as we know our stuff.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Accountancy on Prescription. I'm Katie Singer, one of the partners here at RBP, and today I'm joined by Gary Smith, a chartered management accountant who is going to be discussing all things Bitcoin with us. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Katie. It's great to speak to you.
And you, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Very well. Blue sky, sunny day. Spring is here at last.
I know, we're recording at the beginning of March and finally we're seeing some sunshine. It is a joy. So we have got you on today to discuss something that we as accountants are constantly being asked about, especially by some of our younger GPs and doctors, all about the world of crypto and Bitcoin. And so we just thought we'd get you on and you can give us a little bit of information about your background and what got you personally interested in Bitcoin.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, just to start off, I don't consider myself an expert. I'm passionate about it. I've researched it. I've studied it a lot, but I'm not here representing an exchange or I'm not employed to do Bitcoin. I'm just a passionate person who's studied it hard, like you, like I'm sure all of the doctors that you work with. We all work really hard to earn money. Mm-hmm. So I've spent time trying to study hard to work out the best ways to keep it and grow it. And that led me on to investigating and kind of learning and finding out more about Bitcoin.
Excellent. So tell us really about it, because I'll be honest with you, my knowledge of really what Bitcoin is, I've heard of it. That's as far as it goes. I'll be honest, I've heard of it. And this is why it's a struggle, because often people ask us about it. I understand money. I understand the pound, the dollar, insert any other currency.
Okay. Well, it's interesting you say that, Katie. So, I mean, one of the first things I was going to briefly touch on was the history of money, actually, because when you go back thousands of years ago, like we all think, oh, well, of course, we know the pound, we know the dollar. But, you know, before any of that, there was just simple bartering. So if you had apples and I baked bread, we would negotiate how many apples you'd give me for a loaf of bread or vice versa. Clearly, there's lots of issues with that. So then they used things like the shells that they found on the beach that were quite precious and used that to barter, which helped improve the process. Then we got things like precious metals. So I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this invest in gold because it's quite a common thing that people invest in because there's lots of value in precious metals. When currencies were first introduced, the pound, the dollar, they were backed. They were effectively paper representations of the precious metal that supported them, that backed them. So if you had $100, you could, in theory, go into a bank in America and they would give you $100 worth of gold for those $100. Now, in 1971, Nixon took America off the gold standard, which meant that basically the Federal Reserve could just print money as much as they wanted, whenever they wanted it. And that causes inflation, et cetera, which we'll come on to a little bit. But effectively, money has evolved and changed and it continues to evolve and change. And with the advent of the internet, of course, you can then start sending your pounds and dollars electronically from your banks. But then in 2009, following the 2008 financial crisis, Bitcoin was launched. No one really knows exactly who created it, which gives some people the heebie-jeebies. But the way most people who study Bitcoin think about that is it's a good thing because there's no one individual that is corruptible, that is corrupting the network or changing the rules. So there were some kind of core foundations for what the individual or the people that created Bitcoin thought perfect money should be. I won't go into like loads of detail, but it's just interesting to think about what you think of as money and how much some of these criteria actually tick the boxes for pounds or dollars. So first of all, it has to be durable. It has to have longevity. It has to, you know, stand the test of time. It needs to be divisible. So where gold is a bit of a problem is if you've got a kilogram of gold and you want to pay someone £100, you've got to shave off £100 worth of gold. It doesn't really work very well. It needs to be portable, so easy to move around. Now, cash isn't ideal. Gold is really heavy. But again, these days with technology, you don't literally store your money. It's sitting in a bank rather than it's under your mattress. Or hopefully, it's not sitting under your mattress in cash anyway. Also, things like accessibility. So you need to be able to get at it when you need it and be able to move it without restriction. So if you want to send £100,000 to your great aunt in Zimbabwe, good luck with that. You know, with current kind of banking structures, et cetera, I'm sure you've had the same thing, much smaller numbers than that. If you want to send £100 to another account in your name, you probably have to answer about 15 questions in your banking app to do that. The other key thing that then it starts talking about is, or considering, is it's not, has to be non-inflationary, because you work hard to earn the money that you've got, the pounds you've got in your bank account, you've had to work hard for. But if someone, or if an entity or a corporation or a government can just print that money, it effectively devalues the money that you have, because you have a smaller share of that whole pot of money. And ideally, it's decentralized. So again, you can't, there are examples of countries where governments overnight have just taken assets from their citizens. So you wake up in the morning and you've got no money in your bank account because it's been seized, because they have the power to do that. So Bitcoin addresses every single one of those criteria for perfect money. So I know it starts to get a bit techie and it can blow your mind a bit, but actually, if you think about what perfect money is, it's decentralized, it's free to transact, it's infinitely divisible, it's not really inflationary. It's based on a proof of work rather than just it can be printed willy-nilly as whenever anyone wants to make more of it. Then that's what Bitcoin is. It is digital money. It's something you can buy and store and keep yourself. No one can take it from you. I won't get technical, but if you hold it yourself in the equivalent of putting your pounds under your mattress, if you keep your Bitcoin yourself digitally, then no one can take that from you. So if you want to take it on an aeroplane, no one's going to stop you at customs saying, hang on a second, you're taking your Bitcoin with you. Whereas if you go walking through with £10,000 in a bag, you're going to get stopped. Now, you know, there's lots of those elements to it which make it really attractive as an investment proposition.
You mentioned about it not being inflationary. So yes. How does it go up and down? Is it not linked to inflation? Is it just, what drives the value of it?
Because that's a really good question. And think of price and scarcity as two very separate things. So I'll give you a real example, okay? In the year 2000, there were around $5 trillion in circulation. $5 trillion. Mm-hmm. By 2020, there were $15 trillion. So the amount of dollars in circulation in the economy had gone up three times in 20 years. Then COVID struck, and we went from $15 trillion to $22 trillion. So we have got 4 or 5 times the amount of dollars in circulation that we had 20 years ago. That is inflationary. Whatever way you look at that, it's inflationary. We aren't producing, the planet doesn't have 4 times more things that we are producing and that we are, you know, so in effect, the fact that houses have gone up from, I don't know, £100,000 for a house to £500,000 or more for the same house, the biggest driver for that isn't that property is a fantastic investment. It's that the money has been inflated, which means that every asset that people use money to buy will goes up in line with that inflation. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. It's written into the code. There's no incentive or ability. Well, there is an ability for people that, again, I won't get technical. I'll try hard not to get technical. Keep me straight. If I say anything that kind of doesn't make sense, stop me. But effectively, you've got people that secure the network. They're not incentivized to make more Bitcoin, because if you make more of anything, what happens to the value of it? It goes down in value. It's demand and supply. So if you think of, there will only ever be 21 million. There are currently around 20 million that are in circulation. And the miners that are securing the network get rewarded with the additional Bitcoin that is produced. At the moment, the inflation rate of Bitcoin is 0.8%. It's growing. The supply is growing by less than 1% a year. Gold is around double that, 2%. Right. And because gold price has gone up so much in the last couple of years, gold miners are incentivized to work harder, spend more money to mine more gold. And then over time, that can, you know, again, supply and demand. If you suddenly got more gold in the market, the price could come down. But if more people are trying to buy it, the price goes up. With Bitcoin, if everyone on the planet tomorrow decides they want to buy Bitcoin, the supply doesn't change. Mm-hmm. It's predetermined. So when you get your head around the fact that the supply is predetermined, the only thing that varies is demand. So the reason the price moves has so much volatility as it does is because it is a completely open market. It trades 24/7. If you want to buy Bitcoin on Christmas Day at midday, you can do it. If you want to buy it at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, you can do it. You know, compared to gold, stocks and shares, property. I mean, property, if you want to sell a house, how long is that going to take before you see your money? 6 months? And you can't sell bits of it. But yeah, so basically, you can't get more of it. It can't be produced. It can't be increased by more than 21 million. If Elon Musk takes one of his rockets to Mars and finds 50,000 tons of gold, actually, the gold price is going to crash because suddenly there's so much more gold available. So yeah, the price and the scarcity are two completely different things. But it is a volatile priced asset. So the price can go from $100,000 for one coin one day to, I mean, just recently, it went from about, you know, mid $90,000, which is, you know, 80,000 pounds, down to like under $80,000 because, you know, there are big hedge funds, like any money market, there are hedge funds, there are investment banks, there are, everyone has got access to it. So there are people buying and selling at scale to try and kind of second guess. And of course, Trump putting all these tariffs and then taking the tariffs out, and all of these things are causing spikes and dips in the market.
So the 21 million that are not quite around, but almost around the 20 million point, whatever.
Yeah. It's another 100 odd years, by the way. There won't be 21 million for about another 100 years. But yeah, they're currently being produced.
But they're all owned by somebody? Somebody or people, or some of them aren't owned?
Again, a really good question. There are only two ways you can get Bitcoin. One is you mine it. So again, I'm not going to talk about what mining is and how it works, other than to say all of the transactions that go on, if I send you Bitcoin, you send me, we send it to someone else, all of those things have to be verified to make sure, if I want to send you a Bitcoin, the network has to, there's lots of computers that say, has Gary actually got a Bitcoin to send Katie? And has the address that he's sending it to, does that actually exist? Does that account number actually exist on the blockchain? And if it does, and if enough of those computers agree that I've got a Bitcoin and you've got an account that I can send it to, then it happens. So that transaction takes place. All of the computers that secure that network are rewarded by being given Bitcoin. So you can get Bitcoin by effectively supporting the network with computer power and the energy. The only other way to get it is to buy it off someone who's willing to sell it. Right. So if I have Bitcoin and you say, I want to buy some off you, that's my decision. I've got some. Do I want to sell it or not? Depends on the price, depends on my preference for how long I'm holding it for, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no other way to get it. You either invest in mining or you buy it off someone else.
So assuming that people wouldn't invest in mining, because that sounds like it would be a complicated process, if somebody contacted me and said, oh, you know, I want to get into Bitcoin, where do I buy it? Because, I mean, you said, oh, it could buy it off a person, but reality is you would buy it off a marketplace?
Yeah, so you've basically got two main options, realistically. You can either go on to, you've probably heard of Coinbase, which is a, well, you may not have done actually.
But I haven't,
it's, okay, fine. It's a publicly listed in America crypto exchange that is an exchange for Bitcoin and all the other cryptos. So you can register there, and effectively, as much as I'm saying you're buying off someone else, in effect you are, but it's within a, in the same way, think of it as if you want to buy a share in Apple. You're having to buy that share off someone else that's selling it. And there's market makers that have that. So you go onto your Hargreaves Lansdowne, AJ Bell, whatever account and say, I want to buy £1,000 worth of Tesco shares or whatever it is. Someone mm-hmm. else is selling those to make that transaction work. Mm-hmm. It's the same in crypto. You know, that the exchanges are matching someone who wants to sell it with someone who wants to buy it. There's an application I use called Strike Bitcoin. It's Bitcoin only. We'll probably come on to the difference between Bitcoin and crypto a little bit. Mm-hmm. But Strike Bitcoin is great because they effectively set you up with your own bank account, an e-money account within your Strike account that you can just freely send money from your high street bank to your Strike account. And it's Bitcoin only. And the fees are really low and it's reliable. The guy that runs it is a really credible guy in the space. So anyone who's interested in buying an amount of Bitcoin, my massive, massive recommendation is Strike Bitcoin, which is an app you can get on, you know, Apple or Google, whatever. And it's really, really good.
Something that just made me think of when you mentioned earlier about, let's say, for example, you had a Bitcoin and you transferred it to me. Feel free to do so, by the way. but you said the computers will check and, you know, everything will be verified. Obviously, we hear about risk of transferring money to people. We hear about credit card fraud. We hear about bank accounts getting hacked.
Yeah.
Are there risks in the same way with Bitcoin?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I guess waking up and getting out of bed in the morning is a risk, isn't it? Yeah, everything in life is a risk of some element. Although, of course, you know lots of doctors. So if you got out of bed and fell over, I'm sure you'd be very well looked after. But there's a thing called self-custody, which means you take control of that yourself. Again, I'll try not to get too technical, partly because I'm not really massively technical anyway myself, but I understand the basics that you can have what's called a kind of hardware wallet. In fact, the simplest way probably to explain it is when you have an app on your phone with your high street bank account in there mm-hmm. and you open it and you see that you've got your money in there, the way that you're perceiving that is, I've got a bank account, that is my bank account, and that is my money in that account. It's the same for Bitcoin. You can have your own account that sits directly actually on the Bitcoin system, as it were. It doesn't have your name on it. It's just a randomized string of letters, but you can have an app on your phone that creates a unique login that only you have got access to, which means unless someone gets that password from you, like if you gave someone your banking password, they could go in and send some money somewhere else. But actually, other than that, leaving it on an exchange, there's, again, some people listening might have heard a few years ago of, there was a guy called Sam Bankman-Fried who had a company called FTX, and they all went completely pear-shaped because people that were buying Bitcoin and other crypto with FTX, it all went belly up and people lost money. Now, there's a bit of a meme in crypto, which is not your keys, not your coins. In other words, if you aren't looking after them yourself, if they're sitting on an exchange, then effectively that exchange owes you Bitcoin. Yeah. They're holding it on your behalf. In fact, it's exactly the same, without trying to get too political about it or anti-banking, it's exactly the same with the money you've got in your bank. Mm-hmm. You give your bank account £1,000. They aren't looking after your £1,000. They now owe you £1,000. So that number you see in your bank account isn't technically your money. It's them saying, we owe you £1,000 at some point because you've deposited it with us. Mm-hmm. And of course, at the moment, there's no problem with getting that money out. In some countries, at certain points in history, that has been a problem. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who invest in Bitcoin, they invest a small amount as a risk hedge against global finance going belly up. So there is a risk associated, but it is so much easier now to self-custody, look after your Bitcoin yourself, that actually the risk of that being lost, hacked, stolen, you know, is very, very small.
And we've obviously covered mainly today Bitcoin. Why Bitcoin and not other cryptocurrencies, which I do not know the name of any?
Okay, so taking a bit of a step back, I first started getting interested in crypto back in about 2017. And if I'm completely honest, it was more for, let's call it speculative investment, as in I was trying to find coins that I thought were underpriced and were going to go up 10 times in value and, mm-hmm. you know, ride the wave and sell that and then buy this one. And some did quite well. Some I lost money on. To be honest, it wasn't big sums of money. It was, I guess it's kind of gambling in a sense. It's yeah. a form of gambling. Now, Bitcoin is the only cryptocurrency that is decentralized. There is code written that describes exactly what Bitcoin is. And then there are tens of hundreds of thousands of millions of people and computers globally that secure that network based on those rules. It's scarce. It's transparent. There is no CEO. There's no marketing team. I'm here today talking about Bitcoin and eulogizing about Bitcoin. No one's paying me to do that. I have a vested mm-hmm. interest because I hold some Bitcoin, but mm-hmm. actually I'm not directly benefiting from it. Whereas every other, and this is a really important point, every other cryptocurrency has been issued, created by a tech startup brought mm-hmm. of one way, shape or form. They typically only sell their coins. They don't ever buy them themselves. So there might be kind of a mining element that they've tried to copy Bitcoin, but in effect, they would have issued up, you know, millions of these coins at the start and they're sitting on that stockpile and they can just sell them into the market. They will often have a CEO. They'll be heavily promoted. They'll be all over TikTok or Twitter. They are literally paying governments, paying influencers to market and promote their coins to right. try and keep that price up. So, I mean, some of the ones that I'm sure, you know, if you're asked about crypto, they probably talk about XRP, they talk about Solana, they talk about... So all of these other cryptos are speculative assets that could go up. Some of them could go up in the short term, much harder and faster and higher than Bitcoin. But my personal view is they will all end up ultimately going to zero because they are centralized and controlled and manipulated is probably a slightly too strong a word, but it's not a decentralized, open product investment like Bitcoin is.
Someone in the background is ultimately going to gain, whereas from Bitcoin, it sounds like the creator is, well, not gaining.
Yeah, basically, when the creator first started Bitcoin, they, he, she, whatever, had a wallet with like millions of Bitcoin in it. That Bitcoin has never moved in 16 years. So it was part of that initial mining. Mm. So in the first year or two, when they did the mining and the first coins were issued, it went in a wallet and it's never moved since. And there's no reason to think it ever will, really. So over that period of time, as I studied it more and kind of went down the mine with podcasts and books and critical thinking on it, I quickly shifted to move everything out of any of those other cryptocurrencies I had. And now I only invest... Within the crypto space, I only invest in Bitcoin. For me, it's Bitcoin and nothing else.
So someone listening who's thinking, you know what, this sounds good.
Yeah.
Have they missed the boat? Like, is it too late? And do you have to buy a whole Bitcoin? They're like 70 grand, aren't they?
Yeah.
How does it work?
Again, it's a really good question. And it's such a common question. So first of all, let's cover £1 is 100 pence. Okay. Mm-hmm. I hope everyone listening realizes that $1 is 100 cents. One Bitcoin is 100 million Satoshis, which is, I mean, call it pence, call it cents. It's the same thing. One Bitcoin is made up of 100 million individual components. Mm-hmm. So you can buy £5 worth of Bitcoin. You can buy £1 worth of Bitcoin. One individual Satoshi, which is 100 millionth of a Bitcoin, is worth like...
Pence.
I don't know, a pen. Yeah, exactly.
Bits of a pence.
So, yes. So, again, when you listen to the media and you hear Bitcoin's at $100,000 and people think, oh, I can't afford that. It's just for rich people. It could not be further from the truth. A lot of the biggest adoption for Bitcoin are in countries in Africa and, you know, nations where, you know, inflation is rife, where people are, the currency that they earn their money in is being massively debased. And they will find ways to buy Bitcoin in very small, relatively, you know, compared to the wealth that we have in the UK, very small numbers, but it's securing their future and they're buying small amounts and not worried the fact they're only getting a very, very small amount. So yeah, for anyone who says, I'm too late, I don't want to buy one 100,000, you don't have to. And on that Strike app that I mentioned, you can do recurring buys as well. So you can set up recurring buys for every hour or day or week or month. So you could say, I'm going to buy £100 a month mm-hmm. and I'm going to put £100 a month, transfer it in, they'll buy the Bitcoin and I'll just see what it does. So yeah, you don't have to go big on that. And the same for selling. You don't have to sell a Bitcoin. It's a slight aside, but I give my son the choice every week. Does he want mm-hmm. his pocket money in Bitcoin or in pounds? And he's got on the iPad, he's got his own little Bitcoin wallet. And most weeks he'll say, send me some sats, daddy. And I'll transfer it across to him.
How old is he?
9.
9.
Yeah. So, and he understands that one Bitcoin is, you know, so a lot of the time it doesn't get explained to people. And, the media narrative is just very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Scaremongering almost.
Yeah. Or it's almost like quite elitist. It's if you're a Bitcoiner, all these smug Bitcoiners that, they've probably got hundreds of them and they're $100,000 each, you know, all these millionaires and billionaires and nothing could be, well, I don't say nothing could be further from the truth. There are people that have been in for a very long time that have got a lot and have a lot of money. But the other thing I would say around the too late comment, is it too late to buy property? You know, people that invest in property are usually buying it at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. You know, the house that you buy today for £1 million was £500,000 10 years ago, probably 250,000 10 years before that. But people don't say, well, again, unless you have a view that the bubble's going to burst because of interest rates or everything else. But fundamentally, assets go up in value. Mm-hmm. People that pay into a pension every month, they're probably putting their money into a pension. That pension is buying shares in Apple and Microsoft and Google and companies that are trading at or close to an all-time high. So the price is really high, I'm too late. You know, people were saying that when it was $20,000 and then it crashed to $3,000 and everyone went, oh, glad I didn't buy it. It's crashed to three. And then it went up to 70,000 and then it went down to 17 and then it went up to 100 and it is volatile. So putting all your eggs in that basket, unless you have kahunas of steel is a pretty risky thing to do. But I think where we are now with the level of adoption there is, and I don't just mean adoption with people like me. I mean, you look at one of the biggest asset managers, I think it is the biggest actually, they've got trillions under management, is BlackRock. Now you've got big asset managers that are launching funds where you can invest in Bitcoin, not in this country, unfortunately, but they have in America, and it's been one of their fastest growing funds. And actually, if you flip it on its head and say, maybe it's too risky for me to not have a little bit of Bitcoin. So if you've got £1 million, if your net worth is £1 million, then if you put £2,000 into Bitcoin, would you really miss it if it went to zero? Probably not. Because the £998,000 is still going to carry on doing what it does in the other investments that you've got it in. However, if that £2,000 goes to £4,000, £6,000, £8,000, £10,000, while your remaining £998 goes up in much smaller increments, then actually you're starting to benefit from the network growth and adoption that Bitcoin has historically seen. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, do your own research. My view is it's only going to continue to gather pace and more people and institutions and investment managers will be buying into Bitcoin. So I should have probably said this at the start as well. None of this is financial advice. It's education. It's information.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what I will say to people that express an interest is put a small amount in, whatever is a small amount to you, that you'll be prepared to lose. Go on a bit of a journey, read a few books, watch some videos, listen to some podcasts, do some, you know, just open your mind a bit to exploring. And if you then end up like me, you go from being curious to being kind of maybe confident that it's a good thing to actually having real conviction. So now this is going to probably blow your mind, but now I put money into Bitcoin that I think I can't afford to lose rather than something I can afford to lose.
Right.
Because my confidence in Bitcoin and my conviction in Bitcoin is such that I think it is going to be the best performing asset of the next 10, 15, 20 years. So,
and is that a better way of looking at it, that it's an asset and not money? Like, because I always think of it as cash, money. But is it better to really think about it like an investment? Like if you invested in shares or you invested in property or you invested in art or gold or something tangible, is that a really a better way of thinking about it?
I think it absolutely is, Katie. I think it sometimes gets called digital gold because mm-hmm. a lot of the properties of gold are very similar to Bitcoin in so much that it can't easily be reproduced and printed, and it's an intrinsic value of that asset. And people will say, well, why is Bitcoin got value? Because it's just a number on a computer. But it's the fact that it's globally recognized, it's powered by energy. So it is actually backed by energy because all of the computers that are running the network are using electricity to do it. Mm. So Bitcoin is effectively the digital representation of the energy that's been used to create it. Whereas paper money, pounds, dollars are literally just a number in a spreadsheet. And if the Federal Reserve want to just create another $1 trillion, it's just $1 trillion, enter, and then it's there. So yeah, I think thinking of it less in terms of I'm buying Bitcoin because I want to pay my bills with it. No, think of it as this is a long-term investment. Certainly a short while ago, this statistic was true. I imagine it still is, but I don't think there's anyone that has bought and held Bitcoin, as in not sold it, for 4 or 5 years, that is sitting on a loss.
That loss. Mm.
Because, again, there's a meme in Bitcoin, which is HODL, which is, you know, hold on for dear life, you know, mm-hmm. through the volatility. Mm-hmm. But if you can consider the investment is long-term, mm-hmm. and ideally if you're putting, you know, small amounts that you're comfortable with over a period of time, because what a lot of people will tend to do, retail investors, which all of us are, see a headline that Bitcoin's hit an all-time high and they think, right, now's the time to buy it. Well, of course, it isn't really because often an all-time high is then hit by a dip. So what often happens is people buy it, it goes to 100,000, right, I'm going to buy some. And it goes down to 80 and they're like, oh, it could go to zero, I'm going to sell. And then their fingers are burned and they never get back in again. Mm-hmm. That is not the way to think about it. Just think about it as I'm going to be making some purchases of an amount I feel comfortable. I'll do further research and I'm putting this money in with a view that I've got a long time horizon to consider this over. It's not something that I'm planning on selling next week or next month. And the really hard thing is I now don't feel the emotion of it at all, which is bizarre. Like 5-6 years ago, if it moved a little bit, I'd be kind of sweating. But now it goes down loads. I just think, well, if I've, you know, when I get more pounds, I'll buy some more. And I get more at a cheaper price. And when it ramps up, I don't get overly excited because I think, well, I'm not selling it now. This is my future. This is my store of value. This is my investment. You know, when house prices go up, people don't think I'm going to sell my house.
Yes.
When your stocks and shares in your pension go up in value, people don't instantly think I'm going to sell it. If you get into Bitcoin thinking it's gambling, it's not right for you. It's not, that's not what it's, I mean, people do it, people trade it. I'm not a trader, I'm an investor. Mm-hmm. As I said at the start, you know, we all work hard to earn the money that we earn. For me, Bitcoin right now is the best way of me securing the future value of the money that I earn today.
Fine. So probably to sort of head towards the end of the podcast, I think as we're an accountancy firm, it's probably worth just touching on the tax side of things, because this is the bit that's, for me, a little bit complicated. How does it work in terms of the tax? Is it when you sell the Bitcoin? Is it just by owning it and it going up in value? There's a capital gain? How is it working?
Yeah, it is treated, in this country at the moment, it's treated as a capital asset. So in the same way, if you buy a property and sell it, it's subject to capital gains tax. So let's do a really simple example. If you buy £1,000 worth of Bitcoin today, and it goes up 50% in value, and you sell it for £1,500, you've made £500 capital gain. That would go into your pot of capital gains for the year. Obviously, there's thresholds and allowances, and there's different percentage rates or whatever, but effectively, that's how it's treated at the moment. Right. So it's treated as an asset, not as a currency, because if you buy gold or if you exchange pounds for dollars, there is no tax element. The rumor is America are going to possibly treat it as a commodity, which would mean that it isn't subject to capital gains tax. I don't think that will happen anytime soon in this country. Again, without going down the mine too much on tax, the other thing that will come is the financialization of Bitcoin over time, and you'll be able to use it as collateral for loans, for mortgages, all sorts, because financial institutions are getting more and more embedded into the space and saying this is a scarce, valuable asset that is going up in value. So if you own some Bitcoin, you can use that as collateral to get access to loans. So yeah, there are tax-efficient ways to get access to the value of Bitcoin. If you buy some and it goes up. But fundamentally, if you sell that Bitcoin, it's subject to capital gains tax. Unless you move somewhere like Portugal that don't, if you've held it for, I think it's 2 years or 3 years, then there's no capital gains tax on it. So some of those rules might change over time in this country. But right now, it's subject to capital gains tax like any other asset.
But it might be the case that you bought, I don't know, let's use real small numbers. You've been investing in Bitcoin for 5 or 10 years. You've put in 10 grand. And then in 30 years' time, let's say, that 10 grand is worth 300,000. Yeah. Your gain is 290 grand. So you have got, and then whatever the capital gains tax at the time will be payable. Correct. So there are potentially going to be some tax implications, but that's the same as any investment.
Yeah, exactly. I guess the other thing that will change over time, hopefully, is that there will be ways of investing in Bitcoin within a tax-efficient wrapper, like an ISA or a self-invested personal pension, you know, a SIP. Mm-hmm. At the moment, the only way you can really do that is by buying shares in companies that invest heavily in Bitcoin. Yeah. And there are some, but again, we don't need to go into that. But at the moment, you can't. Whereas you can buy a gold fund in your ISA, you can't buy a Bitcoin fund in the UK. You can in other countries, but unfortunately in the UK, the FCA is trying to protect us all from the fastest growing asset that the world has ever seen.
Is it just that we're a bit slower, or we're just more risk adverse as a country? Why are we slightly behind the others?
My personal view is there are incentives at play that Bitcoin probably doesn't align with within the financial industry. You know, it's not really without trying to get too conspiratorial or conspiracy theory, you know, maximalist, then, you know, it's not in banks' interests or governments' interests for people to have custody of their own wealth. You know, if I send you some Bitcoin today, the government doesn't really know that I've sent it to you. Mm. The banks aren't skimming any fees off the top of that. You know, whereas if I'm going on holiday to Europe and I have to change up my pounds for euros, there's exchange rate fees, there's transactions. And so all of the industry that is around banking and fees, Bitcoin doesn't really fit into that. And even wealth managers, you look at financial advisors, they tend to work on earning a percentage of the assets under management. So if you have a client that says, actually, financial advisor, I'm going to sell half of my shares and buy Bitcoin, the assets under management are half and their fees half. And I honestly just don't think anyone at the FCA has really, it sounds ludicrous, but I don't think any of them have really invested the time and energy to really understand what it is.
Right.
I think they're grouping Bitcoin in with crypto, which we spoke about earlier.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit of a Wild West. Mm-hmm. Coins have gone up 300% and then disappeared completely. And they're thinking, well, Bitcoin is one of them. So, you know, we can't responsibly sell, you know, let people buy Bitcoin. Mm. The thing that drives me craziest with all this is if you wanted to put £10,000 into a William Hill account and bet on the 330 at Chepstow today, no problem. You can do that. If you want to put £10,000 into your Strike account and buy Bitcoin today, they'll probably limit. They'll say you can't. That's too much money. It's too high risk. It's completely, again, I'm not saying you should be able to do that. My view is you should. It's your money. Do with it what you want and be aware of the risks. But the fact that gambling is effectively more legitimate than investing in Bitcoin blows my mind.
Yeah.
But it's because I've done the work, as it were. I've researched it. I've got the conviction. And yeah, I just think it's quite backward looking in this country at the moment, unfortunately.
I'm sure things will change.
Things
do move.
I hope so.
Well, I feel that was really, really informative because I didn't really have a clue about it, and I still slightly baffled, but a little bit more educated. And it will be I think, really useful for a lot of our clients who do ask us about it. Like I say, you've said a few times, neither of us are financial advisors. We can't actually give financial investment advice. We can't tell anybody what they should and shouldn't do with their money. And we always do recommend that, you know, they speak to financial advisors. But from the sound of it, maybe financial advisors don't even touch upon Bitcoin, really.
No, it's that's changing slightly from some that I do talk to, but they can't advise on it.
Mm-hmm.
All they can do is offer guidance on the if a client wants to buy some will say, well, if you're going to, here's the safest, best way to do it.
Yes, yes.
And just to close off, if anyone wants to do a bit more research, I would say there's a brilliant video on YouTube by a guy called Joe Bryan called What's the Problem? It's about half an hour long. It does get a little bit technical around money, but if this has piqued your interest, I would definitely recommend watching that. He's far more articulate than I am. I mean, he does a really good job of explaining all about the history of money and the issue with the current monetary system we've got and how Bitcoin helps with that. And then three, if someone's really keen and wants to read a book or listen to an Audible, there's one called Bitcoin Standard, which is basically the history of money. Bitcoin only comes into that book right towards the end, but that's a really interesting read. There's one called Broken Money by Lynn Alden, and there's one by a guy called Jeff Booth called The Price of Tomorrow, which is all about inflation. So they aren't exclusively Bitcoin books, but they're a really good read for someone who's interested in understanding a bit more about money and how Bitcoin may or may not fit in with that.
I'll put the links to the YouTube video and the references to the books in the show notes. So if anyone's listened and wants to click on those, they can just go straight to them. So that'll be really useful. So thank you so much, Gary. That's been excellent. I've really enjoyed it. And it was really lovely to speak to you today.
You too, Katie.
Thank you. And if you have enjoyed this podcast, please don't forget to like and subscribe. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye.
You have been listening to RBP's Accountancy on Prescription podcast. For any updates, please visit www.rbp.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at RBPCA. The contents of this podcast is for general guidance and informational purposes only and does not constitute any form of advice. The information provided by RBP is of a general nature. Appropriate and tailored advice or independent research should be obtained before making any decisions. RBP does not accept any liability for any loss or damage which is incurred from you acting or not acting as a result of listening to Accountancy on Prescription.